Welcome to Ivy League Murders, where we deep dive on cases related to academia. We discuss cases where the best of the best make the worst decisions.
We look at people who seemingly have it all and throw it all away.
My name is Sarah Alcorn. I went to Harvard, and I've been a private investigator in Boston for 20 years.
My name is Laura McDonald. I work in luxury. I have deep connections to law enforcement, and murder is my hobby.
And together, we are Ivy League Murders.
Hey, Laura.
Hey, Sarah.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine. It's good to see you.
Good to see you.
So this episode, we are John Young and his family are in our thoughts this week.
Yes, we want to pay tribute to a good Cambridge friend.
Yeah, who passed away recently. And yeah, John was such a, God, he was larger than life.
Larger than life. And I always think of him as the most handsome guy in Ringe and Latin.
Oh, my God.
And we're going to pay tribute to his life next Friday with a lot of other Cambridge friends. Right. So we just wanted to give a shout out to a wonderful Cambridge friend.
Absolutely. Rest in peace, John.
Rest in peace, John. And this week we have a pretty interesting case.
Yeah, this is... I'm stumbling over my words.
It's a wild one, and I think it's another Ivy Leaguer who thought he was a little smarter than he actually was.
Don't give it all away.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
Well, I think you know by the title it's going to be an Ivy Leaguer.
Stop celebrating Christmas on Thanksgiving, Laura, okay. For God's sakes, okay?
All right, well, Sarah, why don't you take it away?
Okay. So this episode is the Perez Olivo, Bitten by Greed. It was November 18th. 2006, in the Chappaqua neighborhood where Hillary and Bill Clinton lived. Peggy and Carlos Perez Olivo left for a fun Saturday night in their luxury SUV. They were headed to the Big Apple for an expensive French dinner and the Spanish film Volver. Married for nearly 30 years, the Perez had built an enviable life together. Enviable financially, and according to friends, Peggy and Carlos were still in love even after all that long. The evening came to an abrupt end when they were cut off by a vehicle on Sawmill Parkway. This is an excerpt from the desperate 911 call made by Carlos that night.
Are you last name?
We just got shot.
Born in 1948 in New York City, Carlos Perez Olivo actually grew up in Puerto Rico. He was very bright and went to what was called the American School. And after American School, which was a high school, pretty prestigious high school, he got into several prestigious schools, including other Ivy Leagues, by the way. But it was the draw of New York City and the Ivy League that landed him at Columbia University. Perez attended both Columbia Law School and law school in Puerto Rico, actually. He spoke Spanish, he spoke English.
Wow, impressive.
Yeah. And apparently Perez was really quite a legal savant. I think we're going to call him either Carlos or Perez because Laura and I have been struggling a little bit with this, these hyphenated names, especially, you know. So we're either going to call him Carlos or Perez. Okay. Right. So just forgive us. It's interchangeable.
You can see all the good it did me to spend 13 years in Miami and all the time I've spent Puerto Rico and the Caribbean, but okay.
Laura learned a special kind of Spanish in Miami. Okay.
Yeah.
Perez got his law license in New York and Puerto Rico. So most people know Puerto Rico is a, quote, unincorporated territory of the United States. And sort of in a practical sense, there's no border with the U.S., but Puerto Ricans cannot vote also in the U.S. And they've got sort of limited rights, actually. He found himself with a lot of business in Puerto Rico. I guess it was a major conduit of the Colombian drug business.
Absolutely.
In the 1970s. Yeah. And to paraphrase Somerset Maugham, Puerto Rico was a sunny place with shady characters.
I love that.
So what's interesting, Laura, is that Perez really didn't, after he graduates law school, right? He didn't want to take, he got sort of recruited by these big firms in New York, right? Where he would have to have worked with somebody else. These big name firms, it's civil cases, lots of money. Yet he didn't want to do that. Basically ended up hanging his own shingle as a criminal defense attorney.
I think he wanted to be the master of his own destiny.
I think he did too.
And have his own company.
You're absolutely right. And he took on, actually in New York, a lot of the crack cases at the time that were happening in New York. That he spoke both English and Spanish was actually kind of rare at that time for an attorney. And it was a huge help. Okay, so just to give a visual, Perez is like this big featured guy. If you see him, I'm not sure if I would really call him like technically handsome or whatever, but he looks like kind of like Gaddafi, kind of in a way. Do you know how like...
He has a presence. I think he has a strong presence, and that's important.
Absolutely. And apparently he just had, he was like a total legal savant, and he has actually had charisma up the wazoo. So I've known guys like this. I've done work criminal defense for a very embarrassingly long time now. But there are these criminal defense attorneys who are like, they just got the swagger. I can see Perez working his way through the courtroom, being really charismatic, charming, like the judge and the janitors at the same time. I knew guys like this, nice suit with a nice tie, like bright color. I can totally see it. That's the kind of guy he was.
Absolutely.
So, a real charmer.
Right. You know? And he's working with people who are looking at having their freedom taken away. And I can see him assuring them everything's going to be okay. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But that's the kind of personality he had. Peggy Hall was born in 1951 in Kentucky. Into an average middle-class Catholic family with 9 kids. Peggy wanted out of Kentucky, and her keen sense of travel led her to be, at the time, they were called stewardesses on Eastern Airlines.
Do you remember Eastern Airlines?
I do remember Eastern Airlines.
I had to Google it and like look up. I had to look up the logo because I was like, oh my God, how long has it been since I've seen like...
Well, I remember when, yeah, because they were had a huge base in Miami. So when they went down, it was a really big thing. It was a dream for Peggy, and she was based out of New York City. So that was really exciting for a small town girl to be. Imagine she's flying around the world. One of Peggy's regular routes was New York City to San Juan. And it was on one of these routes where she met the charismatic Puerto Rican Carlos Perez Olivo, whatever.
Perez Olivo.
I feel horrible. I never knock another podcaster for doing this. Having fallen for each other, they married very quickly. Actually, after 6 months, they were married. And soon after, Peggy gave birth to their first son, Carlito. This is the beginning of what should have been a wonderful life and was a wonderful life for many years. Peggy wanted to get back to New York City and not settle down in Puerto Rico. And this was the beginning of what should have been happily ever after, Sarah.
And over the next few years, the growing Perez family, or at least Carlos, ping-ponged between Puerto Rico and New York City. But mostly they settled in New York. In addition to Carlitos, they also had another son and daughter. And so they had built quite a nice life together. And actually, quite famously, were neighbors to the Clintons in Chappaqua, New York. You told me they lived 3 doors away from the Clintons.
Right. I mean... You know, Eileen Fisher lives in Chappaqua. We're talking, Sarah, you and I were in Westchester County not too long ago. I've spent a lot of time in Westchester County. I mean, these are very, very affluent suburbs. We're talking multi-million dollar homes, very, very low crime. And there's not like a bad part of Chappaqua.
But I think with the Perez Olivo family, that there was really a kind of a keeping up with the Clintons problem.
And, absolutely.
And they were okay. He was relatively successful. However, everything seemed okay until Carlos started scamming his clients. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what his whole shtick was with that.
Well, basically, Carlos appears to be this high-end attorney. What Carlos did was he went after, I would say, kind of small-time criminals with relatively minor offenses who were looking at jail time, who were very scared. And he would go to these people and say, I'm going to make it all okay for you. So he would go to scared people, oftentimes people who were maybe limited in education, in language, who were terrified, and go to their families. And I'm talking people, $10,000, $20,000, not huge. These were not kingpins, is my point. He was not dealing with the major drug dealers in New York. He was dealing with people on possession charges, on those type of deals. And he would say, give me the $10,000. I'm going to take care of this for you. And he wouldn't. And these were the type of people I think he thought he could get away with doing this for.
You know, just in his defense, I'm defending the criminal defense attorney. I think he was probably in the beginning a really excellent attorney. I think he probably knew what he was doing. He probably had a lot of sway with juries. He was into it. But apparently about 15 years into practicing law, he apparently lost his gusto for it. However, their family had this really high level of living that they didn't have to maintain. They chose to maintain,
you know, and they never built. So they never built any equity. They never bought. They never built a nest egg.
True.
So they were basically living above their means, and he's working to keep up with this. So they're like swimming upstream all the time to pay these bills, and he's continuing to do this with people. So he's continuing, and he's kind of going after people who I think he thinks won't fight back. So he's going after people who really become victims, people who
Because what he's doing is he's going to these sort of small-time people. They're doing things like mortgaging their houses. And giving him retainers. And he's taking the retainers and not doing
the work. And he's often going after immigrant families, people who don't have maybe a strong sense of the language, who aren't very educated on the justice system. And these are the perfect victims for him because they don't know how to fight back. They don't know how to maybe make complaints. And he's banking on that and getting away with it. And this works for him he starts out this, from what we can see, we don't know exactly when this behavior starts. We start seeing the complaints in the mid-90s. So this is going on for a long time before it catches up with him. So this is going on till we don't even know how many people he victimizes. So, you know, for every complaint, there's many, many more victims. So this is so egregious, Sarah, because we're talking about scared people. Let's say you're facing a drug possession charge and you're looking at 5 years behind bars and you're terrified and you don't have any money or very little money and your brother mortgages his house for you and that's all the money you have and you think this is going to get you out of it and then the money's gone and there's nothing else and you're behind bars. What do you do?
Carlos, I think, what I read about him is that he said, well, I think there was a big misunderstanding because these people are coming from countries where they pay to basically pay people off. Like, in other words, if you pay for a lawyer, the understanding is that he's going to pay the judge and you're going to be just fine. I think it's a little bit of he makes excuses for himself.
He makes excuses for himself, and he uses that as almost an excuse that he didn't do the work. And I don't think that was any of these, you know, I can't say for everyone, but I listened to several of these victims, and I don't believe that was their expectation. I think they had realistic expectations, right, and that he's using that as a way to discredit these people.
Right, right. So he's taking the money and not doing
right.
The work. Right.
It's awful what he's doing.
It's awful if you do that to somebody who's got money. If you've got somebody doing that to people of limited means, it's like...
And basically, he's kind of running this racket for many years. Eventually, it catches up with him. It's almost kind of like a Ponzi scheme, right? I mean, he's bringing in money, and it just... Eventually, he can't bring in any more new money.
So you've got count after count after count. Finally, he gets disbarred in 2006. And adding to that, he actually got disbarred in Puerto Rico in 2000. So as they're looking at all of these counts, mm-hmm, they look back at Puerto Rico and go, guy already got disbarred for basically the same thing in Puerto Rico, right?
Right. And we see the cases coming in, and I think by, you know, early 2000s, he's looking at like 20 cases for judicial review against him, and they keep building and building and building. This is not an isolated thing. This is an ongoing pattern of egregious behavior. So it's catching up to him. Let's talk about the expenses they have. We talked a little about it.
And as you said, the Prez's ideal life seemed like a house of cards.
Right. If you went to visit them, you'd say, this is impressive, right? What you don't know is they have a $5,500 a month rent. Nothing is owned.
And they rent.
They don't own that home.
They had five cars.
Five cars, which are all leased. Yeah. So they have five car payments. They have, everything is rented. their whole life is just kind of
an illusion.
An illusion. Yeah. Nothing's own. It can all be gone in a heartbeat.
I don't understand why they were living so. Apparently, they would get credit cards, max them out, close it out, get new ones.
Sarah, what surprised me was that Saturday night that they go out to dinner, he has three bank accounts. His combined balance in those three bank accounts on that Saturday night was $300. I have more money than that, Sarah. The day before payday, which is literally unusual.
Laura, stop boasting.
And you know, I live way above my means.
Oh, we know.
It's astounding to me that this man with a family, with adult children and a child in college, and I mean, that's scary. The dinner that night had to be more than his net worth.
It's really crazy. But let's get to that night, the night of November 8th. And so they're on their way back from this movie. They're driving back, and they've gone out to a French dinner, and they've had lots of drinks.
And he's definitely drinking and driving.
Yeah, he had five cocktails.
You know? Cosmopolitans, right?
Oh,
so he had five
Lord.
Cosmopolitans, and they're driving what should be about, like a 40-minute drive from the city. That's a lot of drinks to be driving back. I mean, it's really never mentioned anywhere, but I both found it interesting.
Yeah, and so
might be my unhealthy obsession with alcohol, but
so they were driving home, and Carlos had taken Sawmill Parkway back from the city. And so on a dark and deserted stretch of road, their car was cut off by a car with three men in it. And according to Carlos, one of the men jumps out of the car. The man attacks Carlos, and during the ensuing struggle, his sleeping wife, Peggy, gets shot in the head, and Carlos gets shot in the stomach. Then the men take off. Then Carlos makes a 12-minute 911 call while driving himself and Peggy to the Northern Westchester Hospital. We played a clip from that 12-minute 911 call earlier in the pod. So his wife's Peggy's injuries were grave. She never regains consciousness, and she dies that night. Carlos's wound is treated, and he's questioned by the police. So he implores them. He says, find the men who did this. And he draws up a sketch, and Chappaqua is just shook to its core, because murders like stuff like this does not happen in Chappaqua. This is just unheard of.
I would just like to go back a minute, because the whole thing's so ridiculous to me. He starts off saying that he's driving home, and then he goes off, he's gonna get gas, and he pulls off to this little side road, and this car cuts him off, and it all sounds ridiculous to me. Three men, and they pull him up, and then they jump out, one guy jumps out, and you know, Sarah, it's always so interesting to me how, I mean, we've been through how many of these cases, and it's like the woman is always like shot in the head, and then the man is always like, it's always like the fatty part of my thigh, or the fatty part of my stomach.
My non-vascular part of my body got shot. Yes, lots of padding.
Right. You know?
And the least number of nerves.
Yeah. My arm fat has been shot. but my wife's was shot right in the temple.
No, I know. We shouldn't laugh. And that's not appropriate. But it is really, it's such the McDonald thing of like, he's got this like ridiculous injury, right?
We're referring to the Dr. Jeffrey McDonald case, which we were both obsessed with, where his whole family was absolutely
annihilated. He's got like a stubbed toe. Basically.
Right. I mean, and we've just seen this many, many times where the man who is the most intimidating force is very mildly hurt. And the woman who, I mean, in this case, she's sleeping, so she'd be no threat. Just kind of the whole thing seems a little bit unbelievable.
It's true. But then so Carlos brings the police to the area, I think it, like within the next day or
well,
or
I mean,
so.
He's not super injured, and he's out of the hospital very quickly. And then he's being extremely helpful to the police,
he
obviously.
Is. So he brings the police to the area. And what's odd to the police is that close to the scene, they find blood near where Carlos said he stopped the car. They also notice a body of water nearby, and upon dragging it, they find a Walther PPK, the James Bond gun, by the way. I mean, just FYI.
And this is interesting because you say, oh, well, that's crazy, you put the gun right in the water, but apparently this was a needle in the haystack. When they went to look for this gun, they thought, even if it's there, we'll never find it. Because the water, it was so
silty.
at the bottom that they did it in a grid, and the diver said, well, this is a complete long shot.
Really?
That yes, because it was so mucky at the bottom.
Oh.
and vast, and they literally found it right away. And,
interesting.
And the diver said it was just unreal.
Oh,
that
I didn't catch that part. Interesting.
Yeah, that yeah. Because of the muckiness in the bottom, it was complete blackness that they were just feeling around with the grid. And so the likeliness of finding it was pretty small because of the largeness of the area and having to do it on a grid. But they were very lucky. So perhaps whoever did throw in there, it may not have been found. It's just pure luck.
Interesting. What was also odd to the police, Laura, was that the evidence just didn't support Carlos's version of events. The police were left with just too many questions. Peggy was shot in the head between the headrest and the back of the seat. In other words, like a gun put through the headrest.
Like somebody being right behind her in the back seat.
Correct, yeah. And why didn't she wake up during Carlos's alleged struggle with the assailant? Why, if Carlos had been shot inside of the car, was his blood found outside of the car? No, the police and the prosecutor hypothesized that Carlos pulled over, got into the back seat, slid the gun under the headrest, and shot Peggy, his wife of 30 years, in the back of the head. He then exited the car, shot himself in the fatty side part of his stomach, hence the blood on the road, pitched the gun into the body of water, and then placed the call to 911.
Another thing, if there were three guys in the car, why would they throw the gun in the water right there? Why wouldn't they just drive off with the gun?
Correct.
I mean, why would you want to? That makes no sense.
But Carlos protested, said that he was innocent, that Peggy was the love of his life, and that he was willing to take a polygraph. I just want to take a little, let me nerd out a little bit, Laura, okay? Polygraph was invented by a Harvard person in 1917, a guy named Marsden, I believe, who was a Harvard person. Okay, not only that, do you know why it's called a polygraph?
Why, Sarah?
Okay, I'm going to tell you.
Tell us why.
Because what it measures its many graphs, like many, I think. So it's measuring blood pressure. It's measuring your skin temperature. It's many different things.
Like poly. Oh, I never thought of that. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. The other thing that I read in researching this case, do you know how to fake a polygraph?
How?
Okay. So how you fake a polygraph is that you elevate yourself when you're answering the neutral questions. Like when someone says, is your name Laura? You'd make yourself like more agitated so that when they ask the difficult questions, it reads as being normal for you.
Interesting. I know there are people who can beat them.
You're going to learn how to be a criminal if you listen to our podcast. So they have this theory. They just don't know why.
Like, well,
what the what is going on?
I know why, Sarah. They should ask me.
Okay.
I mean,
so why did Carlos do this if he did this?
$900,000, Sarah. That's the reason. $300 in the bank, mounting bills.
You know, and Laura's talking about the a life insurance,
life insurance policy. Which she had several policies, and he had added a few more in recent months. She made $25,000 a year as a teaching assistant.
And she had big spending.
Right, but I'm talking about life insurance policies. Generally,
but she spent a whole lot more than $25,000.
Right, but you usually get life insurance policies based on your income and your earning potential. So she had a very large life insurance policy for somebody who made $25,000 a year.
Yeah.
And Carlos was, no matter what he says, and he seems to say that he had money in offshore accounts, but we don't see any proof of that. He's been disbarred. We should also add that she and the children didn't know he was disbarred.
I think that's really interesting. I mean, I think it's one of these things, and again, it goes back to our whole, really the heart of this podcast, which is about how people are perceived and of a certain class and the illusion and keeping up appearance. You know, it's all of that. You can sort of see his world is kind of devolving around him. Once again, we see it once again.
People really do crazy things in desperation.
Yeah.
This is extreme, obviously.
And Carlos also had he had a mistress. Whether Peggy knew or not, I don't know. Her name was Ileana Poole. And he had this mistress for years and years. And apparently the affair had ended a year and a half before the murder. But the fact that Perez had sent Ileana flowers 2 days before the murder, and that November 8th, which is the day of the incident, that was her birthday.
I've looked and I haven't been able to find it, but I wouldn't even want to guess what their credit card debt. I would assume hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah.
And it is interesting, our perception versus reality. And it's so important in our society to have, to many people, to have, and myself included, to have this perception of looking good and appearance. And I work in a job that encourages that. And I see it all the time. Mm-hmm. But I've worked in luxury for a long time. And I remember in New York, frequently in handbags and luxury bags, I would see people come in who looked very wealthy, and they'd go 2-3 credit cards before they could get an acceptance on a card to buy a bag. And it's like, people do live very far beyond their means. It's really incredible what we will do to achieve
the appearance
of wealth, or of whatever we deem to be acceptable to fit in. And this is an extreme example of it.
Our next podcast is going to be called, "If You Hate Rich People So Much, Why Do You Want to Be One?"
I know, right?
No.
Okay. Maybe we should ask ourselves that question.
Okay. So the police actually took the car apart, the SUV. They took it completely apart. They examined it in detail for ballistics, for blood evidence. They also did an elaborate reconstruction of their theory of the case, where they had the, what are they called?
The dowels marking out the trajectory.
And so did the defense in defense of the defense.
Right. But the defense had to really try to kind of like manipulate it and say the seats were in different positions to try to somehow make this
at all feasible. And also one thing we have to mention too is that, let's go back to that Walther PPK, the gun that they found at the scene. The prosecution was also able to find a former tenant of Carlos's who tell the jury basically, like, we found a gun in a house that he rented to us in a closet, basically, as they were kind of moving out.
Right. Because it wasn't a registered gun in his name, but it was a gun that someone had seen in his possession.
Right. Yeah, right, prior to the event. So he's pretty cooked.
I mean, this wasn't looking good going into trial, and I probably would have been better for him to take a plea.
But
he, typical of his personality, was not going to admit guilt.
Yeah, obviously he gets convicted. I think he got 25 years to life, right? But I do have to say, I read the book on this. It's called One Dark Night. Pretty good book about the case. But one thing that he does pretty nicely at the end of the book is he outlines also there were some pretty interesting facts that just simply didn't make it into trial. For example, that same night, November 8th, there was another couple that got chased basically by a car on that exact same strip of road. So I think it's just sort of like, I think the evidence against Carlos was pretty overwhelming, but there are some things that were kind of interesting.
Right. And I think that's just probably chalked up to a strange coincidence. And had there been more compelling evidence, it probably would have made it in. But there was just too much against him. It was really an avalanche of evidence. I mean, motive means opportunity.
Yeah.
I don't really think he stood a chance. And he's in jail now, and he is still talking and still declaring his innocence and how much he loved his wife and loves.
Yeah. One factor that we didn't really bring up, which I thought was kind of interesting, was apparently he got Lyme's disease in 1989. You know, that was pretty debilitating. But one thing I absolutely love is that the New York Daily News headline on this was, "Ticked off lawyer lost it to Lyme," was their headline on this case.
I'm surprised he didn't just take that and use that as a defense.
You mean for what? The murder or for the misbehavior?
For the disbarment proceedings.
Disbarment proceedings. Yeah, but nobody put a gun to your head and said, "Hey, take people's money and don't, you know."
I know, but
I mean, look, I've worked with criminal defense attorneys, and so many of them are so great and do go to the ends of the earth for their clients. I've also worked with some real dirtbags, frankly. But the majority of the people I've worked with have been awesome, like really, really awesome, and will go out of their way. They care. This is what strikes me about Carlos is, I think he just stopped, he got cynical, he stopped caring. And I'm sure he was like big hot shot, got it done, and it was all really fun. And then he got burnt out, he got limes, and I think he just sort of got greedy. And
I guess it really bothers me, this case. And you and I know of a case personally of somebody who's in jail because of bad representation. You're talking about people's lives, yep, people's freedom, and it's so important. I mean, this is no joke. This is a person who was taking people's money and their freedom was gone. Yeah. I mean, that's just beyond.
Right. And who knows whether he would have put his all into a case, whether he would have won or lost, but you have to in that business.
Right.
Yeah. It's like unconscionable.
It's unconscionable to take cases. I listened to another attorney who took over after one of these cases that he neglected, and she said that he didn't even write the briefs.
As you know, I've worked for a lot of criminal defense attorneys, and most are really, really great that I've worked with. I've been blessed to work with some just fantastic people, but I've also worked with people who, I know of people who are like the Carloses. They don't do anything. And to me, it's just like unconscionable, especially when you're dealing with clients that don't have a lot of money. I work on criminal defense cases, Laura, and even the hopeless ones, I put my all into.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I know.
I put my all into it because this is somebody's life. Jail is no joke.
No, you know, absolutely
not. It is no joke. And listen, I take it very seriously. And I always think, hey, if this were my brother, my sister, my mom, I would go to the ends of the earth. So you got to put your all into it. I sound so preachy, but I just wouldn't be able to sleep at night if I did not like really bring it for the.
And one thing we do see here a lot on Ivy League Murders is there are different justice systems depending on what socioeconomic group you come from. And
yeah,
we definitely see that here. And I'm glad that Carlos Perez,
Perez Olivo,
you know, didn't get out of this one. And now this Ivy League attorney is where he belongs, in jail, where he put so many other people.
Yeah.
So he can do some,
jailhouse lawyering.
Although I wouldn't take his advice even in jail.
Murder.